Okay, the next question is, some people have pushed to have the project buried on I-93. Can you explain how that would work with diverting traffic and getting off exit ramps, et cetera?
Can you read that question again for me, Council?
Sure. Some people have pushed to have the project buried on I-93. Can you explain how that would work with diverting traffic, getting off exit ramps, et cetera?
Yes. Well, sort of. What you have to understand about I-93 is, according to DOT's own policies, it's intended, and I think everybody kind of knows that I-93 is probably, I'll say it is the most important artery in the state. There are others that are very important, but I-93 runs up through the heart of the state. It's the longest, it's the most heavily traveled, and it's designed for, quote, optimal mobility and safety of through traffic. That's why there are no side streets, there are no abutting driveways, that's why there's only entrance and exit ramps. DOT wants to protect that purpose. That when anything comes up about I-93, protecting that purpose, safety and mobility of the through traffic is their number one concern, and it probably is the top three concerns. That means when you're talking about putting a longitudinal, what's called a longitudinal installation, utility installation in a corridor, DOT's policy, number one is you can't do it, meaning running along the highway. That's what longitudinal means, as opposed to a crossing, which is a whole separate animal. DOT's first rule is you can't do it. The second rule is you can do it if you prove extreme hardship, and that there are several criteria for that. The most important one for our purposes, there are others that are important, don't get me wrong, that we probably can't meet, but you can't have any other viable alternative. And our application is, by definition, viable alternatives. So we can't meet the extreme hardship criteria. Even if you do meet the hardship criteria, DOT will prohibit you from doing it in the median or in the roadway. Those are out. So if you meet the hardship criteria, you can't build it in the road or in the median, but they want you out by the fence line. And if you're driving up and down 93, if you look off to the left or the right, you can look into the woods, and usually it is in the woods because it's uncleared area and undisturbed areas, you will see a fence. That's the right-of-way limits. That's where the state property boundary is. They want you out in that area as close as practicable to that. And they won't allow you to access on or off the highway to build out there, which means you'll have to build an access road essentially parallel to the highway, which also is for future maintenance. Again, they don't want you exiting or entering from the highway. So in answer to the question, there won't be any detours for the most part. There may be very few, very one or two exceptions. But for the most part, if you were going to build on 93 for 50 to 60 miles, we would be creating a gravel road next to the roadway, taking down all the trees, blasting ledge, taking out the wetlands or filling them, and creating essentially a parallel access road for 50, 60 miles. So the question asks, well, what's the impact on the detours? DOT rules are designed to minimize the impact on detours, but that means that there'll be extreme impacts on the aesthetics of that road, as well as environmental resources and the trees and vegetation. Your ride on I-93 would change very different. It looked different.
Thank you. Mr. Quinlan, this next question is directed directly to you. says, has Mr. Quinlan read any of the thousands of public comments submitted to the DOE regarding the EIS, and did he note the many calls to bury Northern Pass in Coos County, Belknap County, and Merrimack County?
Yes, I've read many comments, and I've heard directly from many across the state about the options for addressing view impacts. As I said at the outset, we continue to work on that issue. We think we've made a very significant commitment with the one we discussed earlier around the White Mountain National Forest, and we're going to continue to work on impacts. But I've certainly received plenty of feedback on this issue.
Okay, the next batch of questions comes under the general heading of economics. Of course, some of them may stray because there's numerous questions on some sheets. The first one is, exactly what percentage of the energy delivered by the line will be used in New Hampshire?
So all of the energy flowing across this line will be delivered to the terminal point here, which is in Deerfield, New Hampshire. Okay, so that's where electrically the power will be delivered from Northern Pass, all of it. We have reached an agreement with our partner, Hydro-Quebec, who is the source of the power, to reserve at least 10% of that power for Eversource New Hampshire customers. Okay, that's the minimum amount that's available to us. To the extent there's an interest in New Hampshire in a greater percentage, I'm sure New Hampshire can access additional percentage. But electrically, it's all delivered here. Contractually, we've got 10%. Why 10%? Because we are a little less than 10% of New England's load. New Hampshire in its entirety is about 9% of all of New England's load. So we wanted to ensure at a minimum we received our fair share. It's not to say we couldn't request 20 or buy 40 or more. It's a question of accessing that in the market and buying it. But we do have that 10% reservation.
Next question is a follow-up to that. Is this the most cost-effective way to meet the demand this line will serve? Have externalities been internalized in the economic analysis? Has the economic analysis been made available publicly? And if not, why not?
Can you reread that question?
Sure.
I should have all the elements.
Sure. Is this the most cost-effective way to meet the demand this line will serve? It's actually really a series of three questions. Have externalities been internalized in the economic analysis? And has the economic analysis been made available publicly? If not, why not?
Yeah. So, again, what we've been striving for is a balance, one that balances the economics of this project with our ability to site this project here in New Hampshire and at a federal level, and having a project that works technically. Made concessions on the economic side to make it a more attractive project to New Hampshire. We have reduced the benefits by about 20% by our decision to underground more of the construction. We have added several hundred million dollars of costs to the project in an effort to strike that appropriate balance. So is it, from a pure cost-benefit analysis, the single most beneficial? No, it's far less expensive to have an all-overhead construction line, 1,200 megawatts, using conventional cable, which was originally proposed. We've made significant adjustments to that to address New Hampshire's concern and to strike an appropriate balance.
What about if the economic analysis has been made available publicly, and if not, why not?
I know as part of our SEC application, the testimony of our expert from London Economics is part of that application. Portions of their analysis, I understand, are subject to a protective order because they're proprietary.
Chairman, can I ask, sort of, this is my question.
I can't.
I don't think they've answered the question.
Okay. Sir, why don't we handle your question this way, okay? We're recording everything that's going down here with court reporters. They can't hear you. I would ask if you would fill out a yellow card and bring it up here, and then at the time when we make the public statements, you can make your statement up here. And if you may I finish, sir? May I finish? If you believe that they haven't answered a question and you want to make that part of your statement, that's fine. The other thing that I would ask you to do is write your question down on a green sheet like the dozens of other folks have done.
Just read my question, and it was not answered in the way that I had hoped it would be.
Do you have any more of an answer to his question about the... I'll read the question again. Is this the most cost-effective way to meet the demand this line will serve? Have externalities been internalized in the economic analysis? And has the economic analysis been made available publicly? If not, why not?
So as to the first question, it is the balance that we think is necessary for this project to move forward.
There are other alternatives for serving that load. Have they been considered economically and contrasted with this project?
Okay, now I better understand your question. So one of the things we're trying to do is to address the large number of power plants that have retired in this region. You know, you're probably aware that several nuclear plants recently have retired or are about to retire. One in Vermont, Pilgrim Station in Massachusetts. And additionally, coal-fired power plants, oil-fired power plants across New England, including in New Hampshire, have been retiring. So about 25% of the existing fleet has either retired or will be retiring. The options for replacing baseload generation are very limited in New England. We're not likely to be building new nuclear plants, coal plants, oil plants in the near future. We've become hugely dependent on natural gas to the point where over 50% of our load is served by natural gas. So to have any measure of fuel diversity in this region, we need an alternative to gas for base load power generation. The single best, most cost-effective alternative to natural gas that's viable in New England is large-scale hydro. Okay? It's not to say that there's not a role for wind and solar. Those are intermittent resources. They are not going to replace baseload power plants. So the short answer to your question is yes, in my estimation, unless you want to become 70 or 80% dependent on one fuel supply, which tends to be very volatile, natural gas, large baseload hydro imports are the most cost-effective approach to meeting New England and New Hampshire's load requirements in the future.
Thank you. The next question is the rate in the MOU/PPA with Hydro-Quebec market rate or a fixed rate? Either way, is New Hampshire required to accept the stated rate?
So what's being referred to here is a power purchase agreement that we anticipate entering into with our partner Hydro-Quebec. At this point, we have executed a memorandum of understanding with our partner Hydro-Quebec, which will ultimately be converted into that power purchase agreement. The terms of that memorandum of understanding are the principal terms you would expect. You know, duration of the arrangement, the pricing terms, the environmental treatment of the power, the clean energy flowing over the line. All that is spelled out in the memorandum of understanding. It is subject to a protective order. It's confidential at this point, so I'm not in a position to disclose it. Ultimately, the New Hampshire Public Utility Commission will determine whether our entry into a power purchase agreement is in the best interest of customers. So when we're at a point where we have a true power purchase agreement, we will submit it to our regulator. They will look at it and determine whether that's in the economic best interest of customers and should move forward. So everything we're doing with Hydro-Quebec is subject to review by our regulatory body.
The next question follows up on that one, it appears. You claim that the project will have benefits of $80 million, and last night you suggested that people read the London Economics Study that is part of the application. Isn't that study marked confidential, and you have filed a motion with the SEC to keep it confidential? How can we look at the study to review the claimed benefits if it is confidential?
Yeah. So that is the study I was referring to. It's the London Economic Study. It was filed as part of our SEC application, subject to a protective order. So to the extent I misspoke last evening, it was because I was not aware that we had sought protective treatment for that particular study.
And the next follow-up question is for the Site Evaluation Committee. When will the SEC make this study available to the public? And that's a determination that will be made by the chairman of the committee. There is a motion for it to be confidential, and that decision will be made once the interventions have been ruled on and folks have had an opportunity to weigh in and either agree with or object to the motion for confidentiality. Next question. New Hampshire pays about 50% more than the national average for electricity, which is a real problem for keeping businesses and jobs here. It seems that the power generators, many of whom seem to oppose the project through their industry association, are making money on the back of New Hampshire, ratepayers. Can you address how this project will reduce rates?
Yes, I can. And it was alluded to both in the video and in the presentation. This project will lower New Hampshire rates in two ways. First is the suppression of the overall wholesale price of electricity in New England. Okay, so as I said, when you take 1,090 megawatts of competitively priced power, you deliver it into New Hampshire, it displaces large, inefficient, generally carbon-emitting power plants. So those less cost-effective plants don't run. The entire wholesale market price is suppressed. That's about an $800 million a year effect on the wholesale market price. The $80 million that was referred to earlier is New Hampshire's proportionate share of that $800 million. Okay? But customers across New England will see that benefit. In addition to that, the power purchase agreement that I alluded to earlier that we anticipate entering into with our partner will provide additional economic benefits that will lower electric rates for our customers, both business and residential. So the number we share is only that first effect. We anticipate additional energy cost reductions as a result of that power purchase agreement.
Next question is, New Hampshire's forests, farms, and towns provide a sense of place that residents and visitors value. Since the proposed transmission lines transect our state with significant change to this characteristic landscape, has there been an economic analysis of the effects on the natural and historic landscape from the proposed Northern Pass towers and clearing for transmission lines? Recognizing that tourism is critical to the state's economy, what are the adverse economic effects from Northern Pass on tourism?
Okay, I'm going to refer that question to Bob Varney. He's also from Normandow.
Thank you. The Northern Pass project hired a tourism expert to look at the issue of potential impacts on the tourism industry here in New Hampshire as it relates to this project. An expert firm called Nichols Tourism Group, Mitch Nichols, conducted a study of this issue. Mitch is a very experienced tourism expert who works in the field directly for people who are trying to increase tourism and pursue tourism strategies, tourism plans throughout the country. He's developed tourism strategies for, I believe, 7 states, including about 15 years ago. I think he was employed by the state of New Hampshire to develop a tourism plan here. He conducted a study looking at the issue, which had 5 elements, which are described in detail in his report that is in Appendix 45 of the SEC application, as well as discussed and summarized in his testimony that's in the application. The 5 elements of his study included looking at his professional experience over 20 years working in the industry, in which he saw that there had never been any data developed or significant information that would suggest that power lines have any significant effect on tourism anywhere that he's worked. And he's worked on over 250 projects around the country. And this is, I'm reporting the results of his study and his report. He examined New Hampshire's tourism industry, looked very carefully at the tourism data that was developed by Plymouth State University, as well as the New Hampshire Division of Travel and Tourism and the Department of Resources and Economic Development. He looked at the issue of the number of establishments and the jobs that were associated with tourism by state and by county over time, and looked at the phase two hydro project in New Hampshire that was conducted or constructed back in 1990. Looking before, during, and after construction, and what the data said in using Bureau of Labor Statistics data. He also looked more recently at the main reliability project, a very large project extending from the Bangor area down to Elliott, Maine, a large 345 kV line, and again looked at the data associated with that. And the data showed that the tourism economy continued to grow, and there was no empirical data to suggest that it had an adverse effect on tourism in either of those projects. He also conducted listening sessions and interviews with tourism leaders in different parts of the state, and also conducted a prospective visitor survey with prospective visitors in 7 states, the 6 New England states plus New York State, which together represents about 80% of the tourism visitors that come into New Hampshire. A total of 456 surveys were conducted as part of that effort. And overall, his conclusion was that the empirical data, as well as the data from interviews and work in the tourism industry, has suggested that there would be no significant impact on tourism in the state, that there were other factors that were a much higher priority as it relates to tourism. Many other factors were much more significant. And again, I would urge that you carefully read his report, which is included as part of the SEC application. Thank you.
I would just add one other item to that. That's certainly the work of our experts, and it's well supported. We do recognize that there have been questions raised about tourism. It's one of the reasons when you look at our Forward New Hampshire Fund, the $200 million fund we're establishing, we've earmarked a portion of that fund and intend to direct it towards tourism initiatives. So a portion of that $200 million will go in that direction to promote tourism in New Hampshire. It's one of 4 focus areas.
Next question is, we have heard about a possible purchase power agreement for 10% of the power delivered by Northern Pass. Is that 10% of whatever happens to be delivered, or is that 100 megawatts? And is it for all New Hampshire consumers or just Eversource New Hampshire customers?
As I said earlier, We have executed a memorandum of understanding with our partner. It will be converted into a power purchase agreement. The terms of that are proprietary at this point. Yeah, and as to the second part of that question, right. I will say it's a power purchase agreement as between Eversource, which New Hampshire, which is the former PSNH, and Hydro-Quebec. So the benefits of that power will flow to PSNH and now Eversource New Hampshire customers.
Next question is, can you please explain how Eversource generates revenue on Northern Pass through the TSA, and the FERC-approved return on equity?
Okay. I'm going to refer that to Mr. Muntz.
Sure. Northern Pass is a $1.6 billion investment. It's a typical utility investment. Utility companies finance an investment like that with half debt at nominally 3-4% and half equity. The equity rate is regulated by the FERC, and our equity rate is expected to be about 11%. So if you look at that, that's a weighted average cost of capital, which you may be familiar with that term from businesses and industries you're familiar with, of somewhere around 7.5%. So what happens is we'll have Hydro-Quebec will be paying the what we call the revenue requirements of that $1.6 billion mortgage. They'll pay it down over a 40-year period. The payment will be based on a debt component and an equity component. Eversource derives their earnings from the equity component. The debt component is basically a pass-through. We would expect that our earnings on the $1.6 billion investment would be about $90 million the first year, and that would decline down to zero at the end of 40 years. And this project, a project like this, typically has a longer life than 40 years. Should it go longer than 40 years, there's no equity or debt component left. You're just basically left paying the operating and maintenance costs, and those are typically very small. And there are also no earnings associated with that. So that's basically the story of the investment from 40 years down to totally depreciated and just basically O&M expenses.